Hi everyone, I am so excited to have today's episode of Beauty Bosses with the amazing Dr. Gail Saltz. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So Dr. Saltz is not only a psychoanalyst and psychiatrist, but she's also a media expert who talks a lot about topics related to mental health and wellness and how the outer gaze and the inner gaze reflect each other.
That is definitely part of the work.
That is part of it, right? Okay. Let me have you start by telling us a little bit about what you do.
So, as you mentioned, I am a psychiatrist, meaning I have an MD. I prescribe. I see patients with serious mental health issues, but also what we have referred to as sort of the walking wounded. But, you know, a lot of people are suffering and struggling with everything from their mood to anxiety, relationship difficulties. It's a very stressful time. I think a lot of people are really struggling with a lot of stress, and that's the kind of thing that I would see and treat therapeutically as well as medically. But I also do spend a lot of my time and have spent a lot of my career doing what I would call public education, which is trying to help people understand this whole realm of mental health and well-being. The more that you know, the more likely you are to be able to understand what's going on within yourself, potentially reach out to the right kind of person for help if you need it, to demystify a lot of this information, to destigmatize a lot of this information. I started this a long time ago. We're in a better place now.
Yes.
When I started, we weren't in such a good place.
That's something that I want to talk to you a little bit more about, and then I'll circle back to how you got into this in the first place. But since we're on the topic, why do you think there's such a stigma associated with mental health, and what do you think has happened in society over the past 10 or 20 years to help dismantle the stigma?
Yeah, I think that mental health has always been the most stigmatized area of health and not even viewed as health. And I think that that originated for two reasons. One, the mind is, you know, your brain is your most important organ, right? And if you're struggling with your mind, nothing else is really working for you. So that's scary. It's very scary. And some of these illnesses present in a way that we don't understand and traditionally really didn't understand, so we didn't have good treatments for. And I think it was so frightening for so many people that ultimately they didn't want to acknowledge it, they didn't want to hear about it. We just wanted to say, well, that's some crazy people that have nothing to do with me, right? And, you know, I mean, historically, people thought, you know, you're possessed or you're, you know, something really terrible that doesn't have to do with biology. And then there was a period of wish that, well, this could be up to you. You know, if you're depressed, you could just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so it must be like a moral failing. And that was another form of stigma that made it very difficult for people to seek treatment because it was viewed as a weakness. So we've gone through these different stages. It's also very mysterious. The brain is kind of the last frontier of the last organ that we understand, I think, the least about. And that's improving now. But these things made, I think, stigma come to the fore. And to be honest, at the time that I started doing media work in 1993, it was the number one reason that people did not seek treatment is stigma.
So
it was very important, I think.
And then right when we entered this era of having the first generation of medications that can treat mental health conditions, the stigma associated with those was sort of one of taking the easy way out or being over-medicated or being lazy or somehow intellectually not pulling your weight.
Well, if you thought people had control over it and you didn't think it was a biological process, then yes, you thought, I mean, what am I doing taking a medication, and it's just a moral failing and a weakness that you can't just get over it yourself. So it's been really important to educate everybody, all of the community, you know, prospective patients, families, other clinicians, that in fact there is a biological process that goes on. That's how the brain works. And it's not a matter of just, you know, getting over it. And by understanding this, we can, by understanding this, I think we make it much more along the lines of, you know, if you have diabetes, right, you're going to take insulin. We don't say just wish yourself out of the diabetes. You know, we help people understand in a medical model, such that they can feel comfortable understanding that their suffering is real. Their suffering is not just a matter of more effort, and that they should seek the appropriate kind of care, and the treatment works, that they can feel better and they can have a good life. And that's very important as well. So we've had a lot of changes, particularly this last decade, in a wonderful way. I think celebrities have stepped forward with their stories, which is a great model for people, sports figures and actors and actresses. I think people in general being willing to share their stories along with the public education. We've made a lot of strides in neuroscience to understand the roots and causes of a lot of issues and therefore why certain treatments are appropriate. And we've expanded the reach of what people can access for care. So all of those things, I think, have helped with stigma a lot. But I would be honest and say we still have a long way to go.
We still have a lot of work to do. Okay. Let's rewind a little bit and talk a bit about how you entered this field. Did you know when you were growing up that you wanted to enter the field of mental health and become a psychiatrist?
Definitely not. I knew that I wanted to be a doctor pretty early on. And so I did, you know, I went to medical school. I came out and did actually a residency in internal medicine because I thought that I wanted to be an internist or some specialty of that. But during my time as a resident, the highlight of my week would be when the psychiatrist would come on rounds with us and help the patient talk about their life narrative and show us the ways that that patient's life narrative, early experiences, character formation were vitally important in understanding their medical illness. That really fascinated me. And frankly, I saw how strides were able to be made in talking with the patient. And that just became more interesting to me than the medicine that I was doing at the time. So that said to me, okay, I think I won't be an internist. And I went and did a residency in psychiatry and then did psychoanalytic training. I did a fellowship in treating sexual dysfunction. And this was sort of my initial path. The media work was really a matter of my hospital, New York Presbyterian, seeing me speak, because I would give talks, as many academic people in psychiatry do. And, you know, you can talk. And we really need people to answer the calls when we get them. And actually, my first call was Bill Clinton doing sexually explicit things with Monica Lewinsky. And how should parents talk to their kids about what this is? And, you know, sort of, is oral sex sex? And, you know, there were lots of questions people have. Why would somebody in a position of power risk it all? And sort of understanding the psychology of this story. And they said, would you be willing to answer these news calls? And I was like,
can you answer the questions no one has answered?
Whoa, okay. But I did. And you know what? I found out that actually the lay public really is hungry for understanding a lot of things, and it can make a real difference. So that was sort of the beginning.
Do you think that there's a specific area or focus within mental health that draws you the most? And what is that?
So it has changed somewhat over time. But I would say, you know, the area of neurodiversity, you know, different kinds of issues and problems that we may be born with or develop as we grow and therefore have different wiring, has been stigmatized because it's all been associated with weakness. But I found that through my practice, treating people who are highly successful, and through other work that I've done, a series called Psychobiography, you know, exploring the minds of iconic people of history, that many, many successful people have these mental health issues. And that actually, if you look at the research, there are great potential strengths that go along with this different wiring. And that we need to be thinking about those strengths and how we help people play to those strengths. So that area, I did a book called The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius, which is sort of the culmination of that work, has been a big area of interest. But lately, I'm very, very interested in what is happening in society in terms of ageism and sexism combined for women, and how that shapes sort of the whole second half of their lives from a psychological and psychiatric perspective, and interventions that we should be thinking about to help women who are having, not all women struggle, but a lot do. Some of it is because of biological determinants that we have inside, and some of it is because of society and culture's treatment of women who have, sort of outlived their procreative time, or, outlived what society views as youthful and vital and important, therefore successful. These things conspire to make aging, and, women and men are no longer, are living a whole second half of their lives in that time period, and how important it is for us to really understand what's happening there and think about how we can be helpful.
Are there certain interventions that you suggest that either people at an individual level take when they start to feel older or less relevant or more cast aside? Or are there certain societal changes that you think we should collectively embark on?
Yes, to both. I'm working right now on sort of designed a new therapy, if you will, that I probably can't tell you in the 2 minutes, but there are certain elements of therapeutic work that some of which I believe women can do on their own with some guidance, and some of which, they could really benefit from working with someone on, but that have to do with generativity, that have to do with what we create and our purpose and our meaning and how we design that for ourselves, which might be different for each woman, to empower us to feel that we have those same qualities that we felt we had later in a slightly different identity. So I am at work on that. But in addition, obviously, I think from a cultural perspective, from a societal perspective, policy perspective, we need to think about making that broader so that society as a whole doesn't add to the difficulty, doesn't, we're not there yet. We are really not there yet. I mean, it's 2025 and women still get paid 80 cents on the dollar for men. We have some problems, and I think we're at a really frightening time now where there's a real divide about whether we should make that so equal or not.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You're no stranger to controversial topics and kind of interesting ideas. And one topic that you've written about is the weight of secrecy and how keeping a secret is a huge burden for a person. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, sort of the heart of psychoanalytic work, I'm a psychoanalyst, is making what's unconscious conscious so that it cannot so that it no longer drives your behaviors and your feeling states, because you're aware. And unconscious is secret, right? It's secret from ourselves. And so when you have secrets from yourself, essentially, right, that is the crux of a lot of suffering for many people, and making yourself aware of it, which can be painful. That's why we have denial as a defense mechanism. But making yourself aware is what frees you, essentially, right? To be more comfortable with who you are and not be driven by these unconscious conflicts. And similarly, if you are unaware of the secret for yourself, you're certainly probably projecting the same thing to other people and keeping that a secret. How can you feel accepted and loved if you have to pretend to be somebody else? So secrets are damaging your relationships. Intimacy is about honesty and trust. That's the crux of intimacy. So relationships are the number one source of happiness. Intimate relationships are vitally important to us. If you have secrets from within your relationships, they are harmed and they are not as intimate, and you do not feel as accepted. And most of all, of course, the secrets from yourself, which really drive a lot of pathological behavior.
I think that's so interesting as it relates to some of your work also on social media and the detrimental mental health effects of social sharing, because social media kind of masquerades as an openness and honestness and a freedom from secrecy, but yet there's so many levels of artifice there. I think I see this especially with younger kids growing up,
yes,
that it's very hard to navigate. Do you have any pearls about how to use social media in a way that is not horrible for your mental health?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think you can, but I think you need to limit it. And I think, here's where to go back to, you need to know yourself. So some people are able to say to themselves, I'm looking, and I know that's curated, right? I know that that person is only putting up the most fabulous parts of their lives, and so I'm not comparing myself to the real them, and I can tolerate that. That's okay. But if you are looking and you can't do that, which many people cannot, and in fact they may even be fooling themselves they are, but they really are not, if it's bothering you, right? If you get off social media and you feel a little more anxious, you feel a little more jealous, you feel a little more like, I'm not really okay, then you should think about whether you should have an Instagram, or you should have, you know, or whether you want to sign off for a while. Even if you don't sign off, I really advise you to limit the time. So that's hard to do. It's very addictive. It's purposely addictive. It's a paradigm set up to keep you looking. So you have to be very active in setting limits for yourself. So I say, right, maybe you say 30 minutes a day. That's it. It's going to be 15 minutes in the morning, maybe 15 minutes later in the day. I'm not going to have 10 of these different things. I'm going to choose one. You know, set up some very strict limitations for yourself, because the way our minds work, you know, we can tell ourselves this shouldn't bother us, or this isn't a problem, or we're not substituting it for actual relationships, but it happens anyway.
And without our control, I know, kind of control. At a neurologic right. level, we right. get that
so
dopamine.
These people
surge
are not your actual friends.
Yeah.
If you're not seeing them in real life, you're not talking to them on the phone, you're not speaking to them and seeing them and doing things with them, they are not your friends, and you need friends, or you will feel lonely. And there is nothing more lonely than being in a room full of people feeling alone. So that's kind of what social media is. You're in a room full of people feeling alone. And that feels even more lonely than being by yourself in a room, being like, of course I'm alone. So I say limit it. Pick one thing that's somehow very important to you. Limit the time. And have the in real life experiences.
The last topic that I want to get into with you, and there are so many things, I could spend all day talking to you. You're so interesting and eloquent. But as a plastic surgeon, I think a lot about how to help people allow the outward manifestation of beauty to reflect their inner selves, and kind of to have that ego congruence where people feel a little more whole. And I think that that can be very empowering. But there's also this element of body dysmorphia that can crop up in, you know, up to 10% of patients who seek plastic surgery.
Yes.
Do you have any advice or pearls for people who are maybe interested in looking better, feeling better, cosmetic enhancements, whether it's working on their abs at the gym or getting a rhinoplasty?
Sure.
How do you think about that in a way that is mentally healthy and not self-abnegating and falling into the realm of body dysmorphia?
Sure. Well, look, I do think that it's important to like the way you look, right? The question is, what is your standard? So in real life, we age and, you know, and we're not all born looking like a supermodel. And to be able to feel about yourself, right, that you're lovable, that you're attractive, without being endlessly 22 or a supermodel. So you know, people who really, really struggle with that, that's a different subset than body dysmorphia, you know, can be helped, and I think should think about help if that's constantly on their mind in a way that they cannot be happy without it. That's one population that I wouldn't say, okay, you're the one who should go in for lots of plastic surgery until you've worked some of that out, right? Body dysmorphia has nothing to do with what you see in the mirror, as you know, right? It's you know, you can do plastic surgery on them and they will still see the delusional thing that they see, and so they'll go to another plastic surgeon. So actually that responsibility lies to some degree on you, and you know, how do you screen for people that really are coming in with body dysmorphia? You know, they've been to a couple plastic surgeons, or they keep going because they keep seeing, and they report to you what they see, and you do not see it at all. So that's a group that obviously it can be very, you know, unhealthy for them to just pursue the plastic surgery. But there's a much wider swath of, mm-hmm. Of people who fit in neither of those categories, who, you know, view it and, you know, like what they like to do with their hair, what they like to wear on their bodies and clothing, and the way they like they feel like this makes their skin look nicer, or this makes a feature. Or, to be honest, younger people who do have a feature that really has been a source of pain for them, legitimate pain, and correcting it, you know, changes their life and they feel really good about it. I think those things can all be psychologically healthy, to be honest. The question is, how obsessive is the thinking about the thing? How can you be happy, you know, at all without the change? Does some change increase your feeling of, you know, I feel good, I like the way I look, which is great. Those things are important. I think a lot of plastic surgeons do some screening, you know, upon first seeing a patient to try to delineate, is this going to be successful or is this really more of a psychiatric problem that I'm seeing?
Absolutely. It has to come from a place of, yes, you have to feel generally happy before entering into a procedure, even if it is a specific thing that you want to change.
That's right. And, you know, you might not be super happy, yeah, because this might be a thing that bothers you, or you might find aging difficult, and there may even be outside factors that are influencing that. I think feeling more beautiful yourself, as long as that's not the whole bucket, that's basically right, because it won't work. So there need to be other things that you like about yourself, as I alluded to earlier, that you have purpose and meaning in life about, that you have relationships that matter, that are functional. Those, you know, just making a part look better or your skin look different will not fill those buckets, and those buckets matter.
Thank you so much for all your amazing insights.
Thank you.
Where can we keep track of all of your work and follow along with what you're doing?
Thank you. Well, I do have some social media sites.
We'll keep it.
If people look, they'll notice I probably don't spend a lot of time on because I don't.
Okay.
Because I believe my own words. But I do. I have an Instagram, Dr. Gail Saltz. I am on X. I am on Blue Sky. I am on Threads. But, you know, pretty much trying to really post, again, informationally, public education about
Love
mental
it.
Health matters. I do answer people. So I also put that out there because sometimes people ask me for a question. They ask me for a referral. And I do try to answer people and at least point them in the right direction.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being here. You're
Thanks
such an inspiration, and I love
you.
What you do.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thanks.